This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Watch out, here come the robots. Jennifer Gashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, and here's what we've got this hour. Robots and automation are taking the jobs of the people where you shop. As workouts intensify, a harmful side effect is growing more common. Wild, aggressive monkeys are causing headaches for the people of Central Florida. And the Gulf Open may be in Britain, just don't call it the British Open.
Everyone in America sort of grows up knowing it as the British Open and calling it the British Open. But in fact, the proper name for it and what people in Britain call it is either the Open Championship or for short, just the Open. British is a label that Americans started adding to it over 100 years ago once the U.S. Open started.
That's Brian Costa of the Wall Street Journal. He'll be along with that story in about 20 minutes. This portion of the program brought to you by MichiganBusiness.org. The best place to start or grow your business is at MichiganBusiness.org. Contact them today. Walmart and other large retailers under pressure from Amazon are turning to technology to do the repetitive tasks of some workers. Which jobs and industries are the most threatened? Here's Wall Street Journal retail reporter Sarah Nassauer in New York. Sarah, set this up.
So basically, we're at, the retail industry is in the point of inflection in many ways, right? We have the Amazon competition coming in. You have a lot of department stores, apparel retailers, sports retailers closing down, going bankrupt. So there's just a lot of shifting in consumer behavior. At the same time, wages are going up. There's a lot of pressure on profits for brick-and-mortar retailers to deal with all of that. So technology is also developing, and a lot of retailers are looking to use technology, automation, the vast quantity of data to do rote tasks of store workers or workers in the supply chain as much as possible to save money.
Is the retail industry the most affected by robots?
Not necessarily. There's lots and lots of industries that are likely to be affected by technology. And, I think when people say robot, sometimes we think of, like a machine that literally does the manual tasks that, the person did. And that's not necessarily what we're talking about in this case. But there's some of that. Like a cat, we've all used self-checkouts, right? The cashier doesn't have to be there. Instead, someone is sort of manning four or five of those machines and helping people. But there's also a lot that's happening that I think retailers are embracing slowly with just the sheer amount of data that is available about us and our purchasing behavior and how that can sort of replace some of what a sales associate would do, a sales staff in a retail store. That can help answer questions, right, about a product in the aisle. If there's a screen that can tell you about that device, you don't necessarily need a person to be there. And as that gets better, those types of things will likely be used.
Is this going to end retail workers helping you find something in the store? Or are we going to be on our own from now on?
Walmart definitely believes, and other retailers believe, humans and, actual human assistants in stores will be part of retail always. But how that happens and what exact jobs those folks are going to be asked to do will likely change. For example, at Walmart right now, they have online grocery pickup. So you can order your groceries online and then drive to the store, and then someone brings them out to you in the parking lot at over 800 stores in the U.S. So a new job associated with that is the person who basically is doing your shopping for you, fulfilling your order in the store, and then someone bringing it to you. That's a job that didn't exist at Walmart a few years ago and now does. So, part of this is about shifting what it means to be a retail worker. And the reason this is important is this is a huge part of the labor force of the U.S. It's about 16 million workers. It's much larger than manufacturing as an employer at this point in the U.S. So, economists that I talk to, they care deeply about what happens to this segment of the labor force.
What industries are looking at the most worker displacement by robots or automation?
This is from an Oxford Martin School study that, you know, City Research sort of crunched some of the numbers from a study that they've done that is referenced a lot for folks that are looking at this stuff. And basically, any task that's rote, and that can even mean like an accountant, right? Some of what an accountant does is pretty rote in terms of the data that they're processing. Those are the jobs that are at risk. So whether it's rote in the manual sense or rote in sort of the intellectual sense, it's at risk. So we have, accommodation and food service, hotel and restaurants, transportation, warehousing, a lot of the logistics work is at risk, in part because autonomous vehicles are something that people think will happen and play a big role in that industry.
Wall Street Journal retail reporter Sarah Nassauer. It's 12 minutes after the hour on this weekend.
You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal this weekend. Workouts are intensifying, which means a harmful side effect is also growing, with a story this weekend's Gordon Deal.
We're speaking with Anahad O'Connor, health reporter at the New York Times, and he's written a fascinating piece entitled, As Workouts Intensify, a Harmful Side Effect Grows More Common. You know, I'm almost not surprised that something like this came about, right? We got so many weekend warriors, it seems, all these physical challenges like warrior dashes and stuff, but kind of set up what you found here, Anahad.
It's a condition that used to be seen essentially in people whose professions require a lot of physically demanding work. So, you know, firefighters, police officers training, military recruits in boot camp, that's where it used to be seen. And now that people are sort of emulating these very intense styles of exercise and workouts, boot camps and very intense, you know, spin classes, all these sorts of really intense exercises, these injuries are starting to crop up in hospital emergency rooms.
Man, I thought was fascinating, too, is that it's not always just some newbie showing up at the gym for the first time. I mean, like you got at least a couple of examples in the story of people who are fit and work out but tried something new and went overboard.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you see it in the military as well. People who are fit, you know, they can get this condition. And people who are athletes like Amy Purdy, you know, who is won a bronze medal in snowboarding in the Paralympics, and she was on Dancing with the Stars, an amazing contestant. You know, she got rhabdo from training and ended up in the hospital. And so I started to, you know, I've been hearing about this condition cropping up, hearing it from doctors over the years, hearing it from people going to SoulCycle or some boot camp, and finally dug into the literature and, you know, saw that this was something that was becoming more and more common in average people.
Boy. All right. So not a ton of cases of it, but is it fair to say that it's growing or folks are on the lookout for it? How do you characterize it?
Yeah. So since it's not tracked nationally, there's no, you know, nationwide database of it. And in fact, many doctors who see it don't report it. So there's really no sort of clearinghouse. We don't know precisely how often it occurs. But a lot of, you know, this used to be something that was only seen extremely infrequently, and now there are doctors in emergency rooms in places like New York and other cities where they're seeing it more and more often. You know, people coming in after their first spin class, people coming in after a boot camp, people coming in after doing a P90X, you know, high intensity workout. And so it's certainly, you know, it's certainly not extremely common. It's certainly rare, but it's severe enough. And doctors are starting to really see this strange case more and more often, that they're saying, hey, you know, we just want people in the public to be aware that if you go too far, you know, exercise is really good, but if you go too far past a certain limit, you could end up, you know, severely injuring yourself.
We're speaking with Anahad O'Connor, health reporter at the New York Times. He's written a piece called As Workouts Intensify, a Harmful Side Effect Grows More Common. So how do you know the difference between, oh man, I'm sore from yesterday's workout versus, oh boy, I got a problem?
Yeah, so I think anyone who's had a tough workout, you know, has experienced DOMS, which is delayed onset muscle soreness. Rhabdomyolysis is very different. Rhabdo occurs Usually it sets in really quickly after workout. So you might leave a really tough spin class and then you immediately feel pain in your muscles. The next morning you might wake up and you can't straighten your legs, or even when you're just sitting still, you'll feel intense pain in your legs. Whereas with regular muscle soreness, you only really feel it when you start to move around and you start to use those sore muscles. But rhabdo, the pain is going to be excruciating even when you're sitting still.
So how do you avoid this then?
So one of the things that everyone should know is that, number one, you know, it is very rare, and there are some people who do seem to be genetically susceptible to it. But the other thing is that when it does occur, even though it's rare, when it does occur, it's often in people who are doing an exercise that's brand new to them. So in 9 out of 10 cases, it's going to be someone who's doing a new exercise for the first time, and they're doing it a large amount of it. So, you know, if you go to your first spin class and it's extremely intense and you push yourself so hard, you know that might be where it occurs. So basically what you want to do when you start a new exercise program or you're trying something out for the first time is what they call progressive overload. So basically just ease into it. You know, if you want to get into spin, then maybe start out on a stationary bike by yourself, going at your own pace, gradually increasing the intensity, and then you can jump into a tough spin class. Or if you're going to do CrossFit, you know, instead of going doing 100 push-ups, if someone is not used to that, you know, maybe on your own, do some push-ups or do an intro course. You know, basically don't jump into the deep end of the pool if you're not a center. Progressive load, go with a moderate pace at first, ease into an intense new exercise before you really increase the volume.
That's Anahad O'Connor of the New York Times talking with Gordon Deal. It's 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of it with us. You should know that if you'll be watching the British Open Golf Tournament on TV in the coming days, you may be calling it by the wrong name. Yes, it's open to any golfer that qualifies. And yes, it's held in Britain's Royal Birkdale in the seaside town of Southport, England. That's this year's host, but people there are adamantly opposed to the use of the term British Open. Their tournament is the Open Championship, they say, or simply the Open. The only improper name for it is the one most of us use for it. Here's how that happened from Wall Street Journal sports reporter Brian Costa. Brian, explain what's happening here.
Everyone in America sort of grows up knowing it as the British Open and calling it the British Open. But in fact, the proper name for it and what people in Britain call it is either the Open Championship or, for short, just the Open. British is a label that Americans started adding to it over 100 years ago once the U.S. Open started, for obvious reasons, to distinguish the two. But the British Open says it is not, in fact, called the British Open. Part of the contract that NBC Sports signed when they landed the rights to broadcast the British Open starting last year is that they are required to call it by its proper name, either, you know, the Open or the Open Championship. They do not call it the British Open. And, you know, the RNA, which is the organization that runs the British Open, basically thinks that, you know, if they could get the media to call it by its proper name, then eventually that will rub off on people. And, you know, over time, Americans will change what they call the tournament. It's a little bit easier with the broadcast networks because those are business partners with the tournament, whereas with the print media, newspaper, for the Wall Street Journal, they have sort of appealed to the media to try to use a proper name. But so far, for the most part, the American published media has not changed its custom of referring to it. We, like most other American news organizations, call for British Open because that is how most people know it. That is how it has generally been referred to for a long time. So it's just not something that anyone up until recently has given much thought to. I can't say that we've had a lot of talk about it, but who knows? You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you go one way because it feels like that's what everybody else is doing, which sort of only adds to the idea that everyone's doing it. But if more people start referring it to it by the proper name and more people start to know it that way, it could sort of tip the other way where people see that as a more commonly accepted name. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
Why is this so important to the officials in charge of the Open?
To them, it's a couple things. I mean, I think for some Brits, it is sort of a point of pride that, you know, their Open was the first, started in 1860, well ahead of the others. It was basically the sort of the grandfather of modern golf competition, and so the proper name sort of reinforces its singular status in the sport as they see it. I also think the RNA views it, you know, from a business standpoint, as broadcast all over the world. They have broadcast and licensing, merchandise agreements all over the world, and it creates some confusion in the marketplace when some people know it as one thing and other people know it as another thing. So, for instance, in Japan, there are business partners who actually want to be able to sell a T-shirt that says the British Open because they say it would, you know, sort of resonate with people more there because of that. But the RNA wants to, you know, license and sell the proper name for it. So I think they look at it as trying to clear up some confusion and sort of bring unity to the way it's referred.
There's no fine or penalty associated with this, at least when it comes to business partners, is there?
It's more anytime the tournament has a business partner, whether it's for broadcast or merchandising, there is a contract involved in that. So as part of whatever agreements the RNA makes for the tournament, they cover sort of how it's referred to and sort of the logo that's used and all those sorts of things. So it is part of a lot of their business agreements. They will say, look, we've only called it that. We've never called it anything but that. But I think in recent years, they've done more to try to do some media outreach and try to see if they could change that longstanding habit. But it's tough to change the way people have been referring to something for more than a century.
Thanks, Brian. Wall Street Journal sports writer Brian Costa. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today.
It sounds a little like Planet of the Apes, but it's not too funny to the people of Central Florida. Wild monkeys are roaming around, scaring people with aggressive behavior. Rick Jervis has written about this for USA Today and has more. Rick, where did these monkeys originally come from?
So they're native to Asia. They're basically native to like Tibet, China, India, and they were brought to Central Florida back in the 1930s as a tourist attraction. Six of them were basically brought in like the mid-30s to what's now Silver Spring State Park. Back then, that was all privately owned. In Silver Spring State Park, there's the Silver River, and on this river, there's like a small island. So they like brought them onto this island to be able to cruise people past this island and look at the monkeys, and that's where they kind of originated from.
What size monkeys are we talking about? Are they little guys or are they bigger ones?
So I would call them sort of medium-sized monkeys. They basically grow. If you kind of picture what like a chimp looks like, it's about the size of a chimp, but not as thick and not as strong probably as a chimpanzee. But they're kind of decent-sized monkeys.
Okay, so they bring these monkeys over. They're living on an island, Rick. What happens next?
So this is the part that's you know, I don't know, it's kind of humorous, but they bring the original six on to this island in 1948. They bring an additional six, so now they have 12 monkeys on this small island. But the thing that the folks who like brought them over didn't know or didn't realize that these are very capable monkeys and are very good swimmers. So they promptly swam off the island and started to spread down these wooden corridors along the park area and spread out and repopulated, and now their numbers are sort of in the hundreds.
That doesn't sound quite as cute anymore. Rick, now they live in groups, and what are they acting like?
So they basically live in these groups. They call them troops, and they live in groups, and they're very territorial, and they could be docile toward humans and like usually are, but if they feel that any person, human or animal, is actually encroaching their territory, it could be aggressive. And aggressive means charging at them, hissing. There have been there have been accounts of biting and scratching humans as well. So they could be aggressive if they feel that somebody is kind of encroaching on their sort of territory.
We're speaking with Rick Jervis of USA Today. Rick, I think there's one picture that's been going around, a viral shot of a guy that had a lot of monkeys in his backyard, right?
That's actually one of the most telling photos. It's a pretty amazing shot. It's a pretty dramatic shot. It's this man out of Ocala who set up a deer feeder and set up a camera just to take photos of, like, deer. But what he got were dozens and dozens of these rhesus macaque monkeys coming into the feeder, and they, like, learn how to climb up the actual legs of the feeder and spread all of the feed down below. So there's this really dramatic photo. There's got to be about 50 monkeys in this one frame, and they're all conjugating around this feeder. It's pretty dramatic stuff. This is like private property. This is just somebody's backyard, basically, and there's dozens of, like, monkeys on there.
Rick, what is to be done?
That's a sort of really big question right now. I talked to some wildlife officials there at the state who are just starting to basically study the problem. They've formed, like, a working group and are trying to get better estimates of, like, populations. The thing is, there's not a lot which they can do as far as population management, as far as trapping or sort of eliminating these monkeys, because they'll hear it strongly from animal rights groups. And so they have a hard time studying these monkeys because of animal rights groups, much less trying to do anything about the populations. So right now they're in the early stages of it, and they're just trying to study and figure out, like, how many of them are there, where are they, and what are their roaming habits like.
Thanks, Rick. Rick Jervis of USA Today talking about the wild monkeys in Florida. It's 21 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. We're always being told we don't save enough, and yet for many, it's not because we're not trying. Janelle Marte of the Washington Post is here with more on the savings story. Janelle, why can't we save?
For a lot of these families, you know, there were some very steady habits of saving and saving regularly, but they were saving for such immediate costs and struggling so much with income volatility that even though they were saving and were trying to do everything right, the pieces just weren't coming together.
You talk about the earnings that people are making not being consistent. Why is that? What is changing in the economy?
So a lot of times you expect, when you hear about unsteady paychecks, you think of millennials or you think of people freelancing or working in the gig economy. And of course that does make up some of the, you know, fluctuation in paychecks from week to week. But plenty of people who are working full-time are still seeing their income vary widely if they're relying on commissions, for example. You could also look at that for people who are relying a lot on tips. That means that your paycheck can vary depending on the season, depending on the weather, or, you know, what's going on in your community that could affect that business. And so it's really, part of it is just seeing a change in the workforce. You know, you also hear a lot of people whose schedules change from week to week because, especially in the service sector, companies have all this data now and they're able to put workers at the busiest times, you know, which is obviously good for business, but may not be good for people.
We're speaking with Janelle Marte of the Washington Post. Janelle, how are unpredictable expenses derailing our savings?
So this was a little bit of a surprise for the researchers. They were kind of expecting that, you know, expenses would be more or less steady from month to month for the families that they were looking at. And actually, they weren't, because let's say, for instance, one family, you know, if they fell behind on rent one month, then that meant that their rent checks were going to be bigger going forward. So even the rent might change from month to month. And you also have other things like a higher than expected heating bill in the winter or a surprise home repair. And while some of these things are going to be always unexpected, you never know when your car is going to break down, for example, you know, even some things like the utility bills that you would think you should be able to expect and prepare, sometimes you get caught by surprise. And that can actually lead to a buildup of small surprises or small setbacks. You know, the families, the researcher said that it wasn't, the majority of the time, it wasn't just one thing that kind of set them back financially. It was a lot of little things it could be.
Thanks, Janelle. Janelle Marte of the Washington Post. It's 14 minutes before the hour on this weekend. You've probably seen or heard hype for Phelps versus Shark as part of Shark Week on the Discovery Channel. Starting July 23rd, we'll see the all-time Olympic medal-winning men's swimmer versus one of the ultimate ocean predators. Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay says it's shaping up to be the summer of the shameless stunt, but he kind of likes it. He spoke with this weekend's Gordon Deal.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports columnist Jason Gay. He's written a piece entitled Michael Phelps versus Shark. Who you got? All right, so as you cleverly call this kind of the summer of shameless stunts here, explain how you looked at this whole thing.
Well, it does seem like it's a somewhat quiet summer, Gordon. We have no Olympics. We have no World Cup, men's or women's. We did have Wimbledon. We do have the Tour de France, but we just don't really have the kind of signature sporting event you might want this time of year. And so instead you have craziness like Floyd Mayweather boxing Conor McGregor. You have the home run derby with Aaron Judge totally eclipsing the actual All-Star game. And now you have Michael Phelps. Michael Phelps, who has a case of the greatest American athlete ever, racing not another human, but a great white shark. It is this silly season, Gordon.
And we don't have details, right? I mean, I've seen these endless promotions like you have. We don't know actually how it's set up.
Right. We don't know the we have no draft reports on the shark. We don't know if this is a young, up-and-coming shark or an older, experienced shark. We don't know the shark's 40 times or vertical leap. We know very little, which makes it a little hard to bet on, Gordon. You can actually bet on this. Phelps is a 6-1 underdog, believe it or not, on offshore gambling sites. I know you spend a lot of time on those, Gordon,
but
it really is something that is a theater of the absurd. But you know what? I'm going to watch. Are you going to watch, Gordon?
I will certainly watch. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay about his piece entitled Michael Phelps versus Shark. Who you got? Explain, too, because you said he threw out a little intrigue with this whole thing, even though he didn't say what happened, because, as you said, it has probably taken place already.
It has taken place already. I'm sure everyone, including the shark, has signed a non-disclosure agreement, so as to not spoil the surprise of seeing it next week during Shark Week. But Phelps agreed to a little bit of technological supplementation. He is wearing what's called a monofin, which is literally like this mermaid-type tail that you stick on the end of your feet, which allow you to propel yourself at quite a higher clip. Now, this was very interesting to learn for me. Gordon, you probably knew all this, but I didn't know that. Like, Michael Phelps, at his apex as an Olympian, swims at about 5, maybe 6 miles an hour in the pool. You know, so that's not really, really fast. I mean, you can kind of keep up with a brisk walk to that. The monofin gives him a couple extra miles per hour, apparently. So he says it is a little closer than people think it's going to be. The shark, people say the great white shark in predatorial mode, goes about 20 miles an hour. So on paper, Gordon, this looks like a very, very one-sided affair, but Phelps is saying it actually might be a little bit more intriguing than expected.
All right, so you mentioned that the shark is, to best of our knowledge, not in predatorial mode, which means it's not swimming at full speed, right? So this is, as you say, not full shark we're seeing.
Right, we don't know if it's at cruising speed, if it's at semi-predatory or full predatory. I guess we know it's not at full predatorial. Right. Phelps appeared to confirm that. So we don't know much about it. You know, Gordon, this might not totally be on the up and up, this whole thing.
I'm definitely going with Phelps. Wall Street sports columnist Jason Gay with Gordon Deal. Game of Thrones is back, and apparently a lot of us are stealing it. When the premiere of the seventh season was released last weekend, it reclaimed its title as the show most illegally streamed for the fifth year in a row. As with every season, the total number of users who eventually download each episode of the fantasy series is expected to number in the millions. According to HBO, a record 16.1 million viewers watched the season premiere within 24 hours of its release, up 50% from the previous season. But Money-ish notes that it also faces a problem given the increasing popularity of illegal streaming. The BitTorrent trade publication reports that one unauthorized streaming website was seeing 20,000 people an hour illegally playing the latest episode of Game of Thrones. Meanwhile, a recent survey by Finder.com found over 5% of Americans admitted to illegally streaming or downloading the television adaptation of George R.R. Martin's series, and that may translate to around 10 million people. Now, HBO is a cash cow for parent Time Warner, so the unwillingness of a significant part of the population to pay $15 a month for an HBO Go subscription is a big problem. One popular estimate suggests the network may lose as much as $45 million each season to Game of Thrones piracy. Westworld, another popular HBO program, is also a favorite among pirates. That'll do it for this hour. For Gordon Deal, I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.